Good morning. I am Peggy Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and your fellowship and sponsorship, I have been sober since February 4th, 1964. And for that, I am amazed and grateful. I can tell, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is basically divided into two groups, just like society is. And that those two groups consist of happy asses and sad asses. Now, happy asses are those people who celebrate sobriety, and sad asses are those people who suffer it. This group is a bunch of happy asses, and I can tell that. We're going to do this in four different classes, and we're going to ad-lib a lot because we have a little guide that we go by. But as an alcoholic, did you ever follow instructions? How many of you have sat up on Christmas Eve and said, "Oh, this is simple," and thrown the instructions away, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're looking for them in the trash can? So we're just sort of going to go along with this in a real loose and easy manner. And really, if you have questions, please write them down ahead of time while you're thinking of it. Because, you know, I have a good memory, but it's real, real short. And I forget the good things that I want to ask. If it had not been for sponsorship, I would not be standing here today. Now, by that I mean not only that I have had a sponsor for the time that I have been sober, but I have also been sponsoring. I truly believe this, and I have found nothing to contradict me in this yet. I truly believe that my purpose in this world is to serve other people. Now, it has taken me an awful long time to come to that belief. And I'm not talking about just alcoholics, but I'm talking about the whole shebang. And the reason I feel that way, first of all, I know Chuck Chamberlain, who many of you have heard of and admired and respected, died very recently. And he said that he really believed that his purpose in life was to serve other people, to be in this world to do that. And why is it so necessary for me to do that? It's necessary for me to do that because I am still a very selfish alcoholic. You know, on the outside, you may say, "Gee, that's a nice woman. Here she is giving of herself," you know. And there are mornings when I get up, and I really don't, truly, and this is the truth, I hardly even know that God is up until about 10 o'clock. And I certainly hardly ever speak to him till then because I might say some bad things because I'm not real good in the morning. So I've been awake about 23 minutes and cognizant and in the spirit of God's grace for about that period of time. And so, you know, I am still I'm just an alcoholic. And I don't know how to say that any other way except that I do not suffer from the ravages of alcohol. I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. And do you know, it took me about 10 years to figure that out. Now, it means that, you know, I drank. Sure, I drank. You know, I love to drink. I mean, I was not one of your little old tiny ladies who went around sipping out of a bottle of sherry now and again. I drank a fifth of vodka a day when I could get it. And if I could get more and not pass out, I drank that. So I am what you call a real alcoholic. Now, I don't want you to go home and say that I called you a fake alcoholic. But there are those people, and they usually are in the sad ass bunch, who are sort of simple alcoholics. Now, I'm a real alcoholic, and being a real alcoholic means that I have to do everything that I can. Now, I go to 5 meetings a week. You think I go there because I'm wonderful? Are you wonderful? If you're wonderful, I don't like it. Right now, I don't like it because I'm not wonderful. I'm raunchy. I have fears. I get angry. You know, the girls used to love to ride with me to Central Committee meeting or your inner group because all the way home, I'd be scheming. Boy, I'm going to get revenge. And, of course, I never did that sort of thing. I never did it. But the point is that I'm not wonderful. And I'd like, you know, I would love to be able to say to you, I have this marvelous relationship with my Creator. But if I told you that, I'd be lying. You know, my relationship with my God, as I understand Him, depends almost entirely how much I am willing to get out of the way. Stay out of the way, my own way. Because when I'm in that way, then the message that God is sending me isn't going to get through. And you know what His messengers are for me? Do you know what an angel is? An angel is God's messenger. So I have a whole bunch of these little raunchy-looking angels creeping along behind me. Some of them won't wear their halos. Some of them won't wear their wings. Some of them like their togas, and some of them don't. Some of them like, you know, having one wing and says, and those are the people that I sponsor. They are the messengers. My sponsor, who is 67 years old, goes to 5 meetings a week and is sober 22 years. And she is, oh, she's just a hellraiser is all it is. She just is. And that's, I like that because she's a human too. So I need to give of myself tremendously. When are you really at your best? You know that feeling of just being swept into something, of that clean, good feeling of pitching something that you really believe in? I'm at my best on 12-step work. And when I am one-to-one with a girl that I sponsor, when there is that beam from me to you that nothing is in the way of, that clean, good feeling of, Eureka, I think I got it. You know, that spirit that is there. That is when I am at my best. So I must be absolutely certain to place myself in the atmosphere where that is going to happen as often as possible. And that gives my life that spiritual commodity that otherwise I don't have. So I've got to place myself in meetings. I go to 5 meetings a week. I work on committees. I sponsor people. I get out, take the 12-step calls and when I can. And I like being on, this is kind of a crude term, but there's nothing else. I like being on the vomit line. I like being down there with those people, you know, because that's when I am my best. I'm not at my best when I drag out of the bedroom in the morning, you know, and stare at Dick like he was a stranger, you know. But I am at my best when I'm pitching AA and when I'm trying, because God, it was done for me. And isn't that the whole secret in this, is it was done for me. And my initial entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous was a lot of meetings and sponsorship. And that's what I've been doing, because I do what I found successful. And for a real alcoholic like me, that's the best thing. So I try to place myself in that solution, in that atmosphere where I'm going to hear those things and see those people and pick up on those things. That's, you know, that's my life. It's my life. The structure of sponsorship and the structure of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've heard many people say lots of times, and you've heard it too. Oh, God, when you get sponsored by X, Y, or Z, you're nothing but a dummy, you know, and you're a puppet. You just puppet around and everything, you know. I needed that because the structure allowed my disease of alcoholism to be under restraint, and it freed me. We are children of chaos. Don't we like to create chaos? I mean, there is nothing like a good, chaotic day. Just full of self-will. No, but then some messenger calls, you know, and you, oh, answer the phone again, you know, and you say, hello? You act as if you're glad to hear from them, and there you are. Now, there's a lot of ways to get people to when you go on 12-step calls, and I think most of you know that. If you are a happy, yes, you know that. You get your name on the deal down at the central office, you know. You go to hospitals. You go to institutions. You go to the jails, the prisons, and so forth. You pick up people. You pick up people to make 12-step calls on and to sponsor. And the difference between 12-step work and sponsorship is merely continuum. It's a continuum. 12-step work is one time, you know, one time shot. But sponsorship is that same thing.
Every day.
No. And so, you know, you need to think carefully about it. But let me tell you something. I have known people who have been sober 6 months who are better qualified to sponsor people than people who have been sober for a long time. You think old Bill and Bob hung around and said, well, we don't have enough sponsors to sponsor each other. What would we have done? What would we have done? Now, obviously, there are judgments called there, but now, Dick, we're going to kind of alternate up here so, because we're both really talky people, but he's going to come up and handle the next part of the first class.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dick Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. But for the grace of God, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since September the 15th, 1965. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I am concerned, is strictly the fact that I've been able to stay sober, and I had no intention of doing so when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to get it off my back. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I listened to somebody else for the first time in my arrogant, self-centered life, and I did what someone else suggested. I think that the predominant thing, there's a lot of things I'd like to say. First of all, you know, I've read the GSO pamphlet on sponsorship, and like many of you have, and I reread it this past week before I came down here. And I'm continually amazed that there's as much in there that I agree with as there is. And frankly, there isn't a lot. But I'm amazed that there is something in there that I can agree with. Sponsorship originally started out, and it was a very hard-line situation. And it was a very hard-line situation, as many of you know, that who get somebody and they'd get them on their knees, and they would have to humble themselves, and they would have to say that they really want this thing, and so on and so forth. And they had to admit to some sort of recognition of God in their lives. And it was almost God as Bill and Bob described it. And Alcoholics Anonymous, when it was new, was very much a religious organization. And it really was. Thank God it's not that anymore. That's why it didn't grow very fast at first, I'm sure. We had a moment of silence here this morning before the meeting started, and that moment of silence initially was a reading from the Bible in the early days in AA, and they gradually dropped that and had a moment of silence instead. So AA has changed, and the face of AA has changed, and sponsorship has changed. But it really hasn't changed all that much, because sponsorship started, actually, sponsorship as we know it today probably started in Cleveland when Clarence Snyder had gotten the Plain Dealer, a fellow to write some articles in the Plain Dealer newspaper, and there were a series of six of them, and Cleveland was just flooded with new people, and they only had six or seven sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they had literally 500 or 600 requests, and those people who had been sober for even a short time went out on 12-step calls, and those people became sponsors, and they showed that AA could work in large groups of people. And it started out in that the sponsor was really in control of the people that they were sponsoring, and they had very great structure to it, and they were very hard-nosed, and you had to do what your sponsor said or else they kicked you out of AA. And, you know, that's simple enough. I sometimes kind of think that something is wrong with AA, that they dropped that. I think that maybe we ought to have, you know, some big people in AA, great big ones, and that we could call up and say, well, John didn't do what I told him to last night. Would you take care of it? And they'd go out the next day and see John and say, John, I understand you told your sponsor bullshit, and what we're going to do this time is just break one of your legs. That way it would certainly make sponsorship a hell of a lot easier, I can tell you. You know, you guys would really shape up quick. But that's really not what sponsorship is about, is it? You know, it's really not what sponsorship is about. But I can tell you, we sponsors would like it to be that way. And don't ever kid yourself, because it's a very frustrating sort of a thing to go through. With trying to help somebody and trying to get them to understand that the actions that you are suggesting to them are more important than their intellect or what they're thinking. I have had to have someone else's actions superimposed over my thinking, because my thinking is too self-centered, and it's too selfish, and it's too greedy, and it's much too resentful for me to be able to make always clear decisions in my life. And so I have to have someone to do that for me. I have to have someone impose actions upon my intellect so that I can end up doing the right thing. Otherwise, the decisions that I'll be making in my life are going to be extremely self-centered, and they're going to be only to my benefit. That particular and peculiar man that I have chosen to be my sponsor, some of you may know, or you may know of, or you may have heard him at one time or another. His name is Clancy I. Now, Clancy doesn't like it when you don't do what he says. I can tell you that from experience. I have never heard him say anything nice about me in public. He says nice things to me privately, but not often. But he says it's not his job to say nice things to me. He says that's the job of the people that you sponsor. They say nice things about you. He says, my job is to tell you where you're not wonderful. And Peggy was talking about being wonderful a while ago. And, you know, I think that the real thing that I would like to be in life is I would like to be human. I would like not to be caged up like an animal. And I certainly don't want to be above those people around me or those people that I associate with, because then I would look down upon them. And I think that we're all God's children. And I believe that to the marrow of my bones. But sometimes I also think that occasionally I get this thought in my mind that God had too many children, too. You know, you and you over there. You know. But so wonderful is not what I am. And I'm just a human being. I'm just another you. I've been sober for a while. I've been sober for a longer period of time than most of you in this room, but there are some in here that have been sober longer than I have. And they have shared their experience either directly or indirectly with me in what they do. And I say they have shared it because those people who come before me in Alcoholics Anonymous have shared and shared and shared, and it's gone down one member to the other so that I've been able to hear what I need to hear. And I've been able to select as best I can those things which seem to be the most pragmatic. And pragmatism means something that's practical and works. And it's the pragmatic, practical suggestions that have been given to me that have allowed me to stay sober and that have allowed me to become active in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's an awful lot of people in the world in AA who have been able to tell me how to sponsor. And they will come up and say, well, some of the fellows that I sponsor tell me how to sponsor them, for an example. You know, I think that's always interesting. But there's a lot of people who have been able to tell me how to sponsor. But there have been damn few who have really been able to show me how. And so those few that I look to who have shown me how are the ones that I follow, because I believe them. I sponsor currently 37 people. And that seems like it would be a terrible burden. Peggy sponsors 25 or 26 gals right now. And that seems like it would be a terrible burden. But sponsoring that number of people allows me to do one very simple thing. It allows me to allow Peggy to live. Otherwise, I'd kill her. Yeah. The continual interruptions that we get in our lives have allowed us to live together as man and wife in a good marriage for over 18 years. And I mean, you know, I've been sober now, you have to bear in mind, Peggy and I got married before I was sober a year. And my sponsor told me that was okay because she'd been sober longer than I had, and it was all right for me to do that. And if there are some of you in here that think that I got involved in some emotional relationship before a year, you're wrong, because the relationship that we had up until the time I had a year of sobriety was nothing but pure lust. And after that 1 year, it could become an emotional relationship, a meaningful relationship. But I had to, just to give you a simple example, Peggy and I were talking about getting married, and I told her, I said, well, you know, let's do get married, and I want to get married, but I have to call my sponsor first. And that might sound funny to you, but I had made a decision to follow what my sponsor had suggested, and he suggested that I call him when I was going to make any major decisions in my life. And that is forever, forever. I call my sponsor now when I have a major decision to make in my life. And that's what AA is all about, because I want to make sure I'm doing the right thing, because believe me, I screwed up an awful lot before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've done my share of screwing up since I've been in AA, and usually that was because I didn't ask my sponsor first. So sponsorship has played a heavy role in my life, both as being sponsored, and I have been since I've been in AA continually, and in being a sponsor. And I've had some excellent leadership given to me. And I like to think to myself that sponsorship is really the backbone of AA. And I like to think that of all the things that I do in AA, and I do many things in AA, and I have ever since I've been active, which is ever since I've been sober, really, I think that that's probably the most important thing and the thing that I do the best. And the thing that I enjoy the most. Hi, Lou. It's good to have you down from Little Rock. We started at 10, Lou. But we haven't been sober as long as you have. It's all right, Lou. Your pigeons were down here on time, though. They got here last night. The value of going through some sort of a guidance situation is most valid simply because I didn't know what the hell to do. I didn't know what the hell to do. And I want to get started now and talk about the beginning. I want to talk about 12-step work. And when you go on a 12-step call, two people should go, and two people should go for one very simple reason. If it's a woman that's being called on, two women should go. If it's a man that's being called on, two men should go. And preferably someone that you would take along with you who had been either, if you have been a short time in AA and haven't had any experience on 12-step work, get your sponsor to go with you. And if you are a sponsor and you're called upon to go on a 12-step call, take one of those people that you sponsor with you so that they can see how it's done, so that they can get over the initial fright of, well, what if I say something wrong? You can't say anything wrong. It's impossible to say anything wrong, because very simply what you are is one alcoholic talking to another, and you have only your experience to give. That's the only thing that I have to give to you is my experience. You know, I would like to think that I could give you my intellect, but some of you already have more than I have, so you don't want mine. And some of you with less don't recognize how much more I have. But I think that what we have to do is to remember that two people should go on a 12-step talk. And there's a very valid reason for that. And the reason is that the person that you're going to see is absolutely perfect in their illness, and you're not perfect in your recovery. You are not perfect in your recovery. And I am not perfect in my recovery. So if at all possible, certainly take one with you when you go on a 12-step call. And there are other things that you have to remember that in taking two people and the validity of it. I remember one of the early 12-step calls went on with my sponsor. And this fellow was a bookie, it happened to be. And I went, and we went into this apartment house, and it had the lush carpets and the silent elevators and, you know, all that. And we rode up to the floor where he was, and went and knocked on the door, and he came to the door shaking and red-faced and just a mess. And, you know, he was skinny, and he didn't have any, he looked like he'd had his ass shot off in the war. You know, he was down to that point where he wasn't eating, he was just drinking. And he was really in bad shape. And he wanted to make sure that he was able to get the money that he had to the boss, or he'd get hung, I guess. But we walked in this very beautifully decorated apartment, and you know, on the dining room table, there were bills stacked up about 8 to 9 inches high. And it was covered with these. Money. I mean, there was thousands of dollars there. And I mean literally thousands of dollars. I have no idea. $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 easily on that table. And we sat and we talked to him for a while, and he said it was so nice for us to come up there, and he said that he wanted to give us some money, and he gave each of us a sheaf of $20 bills, and there were $1,000 in each of these sheaths that he gave us. And my sponsor said, no, we can't take that. We can't accept money from outsiders, and certainly we don't get paid for doing what we're doing. We're only here making a 12-step call on you to get something out of it for ourselves, and we don't need to be paid for it. And he says, well, maybe you could give it to the fellowship, give it to AA, those people that you've talked to me about, those people who have less, or maybe to decorate a clubhouse or something like that. And we said, no, we can't accept that. And he was absolutely insistent. And in the interim period, he had called the liquor store, and the fellow came up and brought in some booze, and he got instantly well just as soon as he took a drink, and we decided there wasn't any sense in staying there any longer. And the more he drank, and we weren't there that long, he got instantly well, but the more he drank, the more he insisted on us taking this money. And we walked out of the apartment, and we were walking down the hall, and he threw the money at me. I mean, literally, this happened. And there was a lady of some questionable repute walking down the hall, and we asked her if she was going into that apartment, and she said yes. And we said, well, would you mind taking this in there? He threw it to us, and we can't keep it. And so she took the money back and gave it to him. And we went downstairs in the elevator and got out and went and got over in the car. My sponsor at that time had a Valiant that I had to get out and unlock the hood and turn the propeller around so that it could start right. And I'd get back in and sit down. He dubbed me Gloves because he had a pair of dirty gloves in there so I could get in there and work on the engine for him. And so I just went to the glove compartment, got the gloves, went over and undid the hood and spun the propeller around so it would connect up, and got back in, and he started the car, and off we went. And he said, well, now you see why it's necessary for two people to go on a 12-step call. And my sponsor at that time financially was not very well off. As a matter of fact, he was doing very poorly. Now, I was a new man, and I was doing worse, and I want you to know that. And I said, yes, I can understand why. And he said, why? And I said, because if I hadn't been along, you'd have kept the money. You can see what I had on my mind. And he said, no, Dick. He said, because he would have accused us of stealing the money later. And so I learned. So that there is a tremendous validity in taking two people along. There's a tremendous safeguard in thinking and in direction. You know, you're not really going to do something else when someone is there that's bad. You're really going to do good. And you're going to be God's messenger for that individual and try to do the best that you can. Only because there's another one there that'll tell on you if you don't. You know, if nothing else, it has that validity. But, you know, the object in going on a 12-step call is to share your experience. And you talk about your drinking experiences. And if he's in a light mood and battering back and forth, let him talk about some of his. and tell him about the twisted thoughts that came into your mind before taking the first drink and those things that happened to you. And you try to talk to them and find out where they're coming from, what they do for a living, what their religious background is, and do they have any concept of a higher power. And don't try to tell them about yours, for God's sake, but, you know, try to find out what they think. And so that maybe you can put yourself in their position and see where they're coming from to get a little help. It isn't always simple to get previous information on somebody, although sometimes that happens from a family member who wants you to make a 12-step call on somebody. Maybe you can know a lot about them at first, but most of the time the 12-step calls we go on are blind, and we really don't know anything about the people that we're going to say. But the object is to engage them in the conversation and to talk about it, and talk about the symptoms of alcoholism, and talk about your experiences. And don't try to push him into talking unless he wants to. And if he wants to, encourage him and have a conversation with him. Let him talk. Listen to what he has to say, because what he has to say will be give you a better idea of how you're supposed to proceed from there. You know, does he really have a desire to stop drinking? That's what you want to know. Does he really have a desire? But after he's accepted you as a person who knows something about drinking, you can describe yourself as an alcoholic and tell him what happened to you in your recovery and explain to him how alcohol affects taking the first drink affects your thinking and your mind and how it starts the compulsion and how the obsession sets in and you can't do anything about it. But talk about only your experiences. Don't talk about the other experiences of other people in the group. Talk about your own experiences and let them relate to that. And if you think that your experiences haven't been bad enough, that's tough. They're enough for that fellow, because what you're doing is you're talking about how you feel, how you felt when you were drinking and how you felt when you were not drinking. And talk about the restlessness and the irritability and the discontent that you suffered. And talk about the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization you felt when you were not drinking. Talk about what happened to you that made you go back to drinking. And if he's interested and wants to know how you got well, tell him exactly what happened to you. Tell him about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell him about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell him about the meetings. And tell him about, you know, not specifically the people that go to AA, but just tell him that AA is a cross-section of all society, and there are people from all walks of life who come to AA. And give him an idea of what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. Outline the program of action. Tell him what you do. Tell him what you did when you first came to AA. Tell him about going to a meeting every night. Tell him about calling your sponsor. Tell him about being in regular contact during the day with other members. Tell him about eating something sweet when you feel like taking a drink. Just tell him about how you itched when you first got sober and what you did about the itches. Tell him about your legs and arms waking up in the morning and going to, and they were asleep when you woke up in the morning and the rest of you was awake. And tell him about how that goes away. Let him know about those things, the symptoms of physical recovery. So that he won't think that he is different, he or she, whoever it happens to be. Suggest how important it is that he place the welfare of others really ahead of himself, and tell him how eventually he could help others as you're trying to help him. Offer him your phone number, offer to take him to a meeting, and if he wants to go, fine. And if he really refuses or doesn't want to go, don't pester him. Just give him your phone number. Give him an opportunity to get in touch with you again. Tell him that you're just there to help him. And if he wants help at a later time, then you'll be glad to provide it. If he seems to be willing, of course, take him to a few meetings and see if you can give him some help. You know, it's... Again, I don't want to overstress the idea of taking two people go on a 12-step call. Sometimes you want to see the person alone, and sometimes there's a wife hovering about, or sometimes there's a husband hovering about. Get the other person to take that person in the other room. Tell them to go boil water or something. You know, get rid of them. Or if you can, if the person is mobile, you know, take them out and get them a cup of coffee. Go to a restaurant. Go to some neutral place so they won't be intimidated by the presence of those people around them, those well-meaning but sometimes lethal members of the family who will prevent you from being able to say the things that you need to say and who will prevent that newcomer from being able to say the things that they need to say. Because they minimize everything, and certainly we minimize everything too when we're new. But remember that they're going to minimize their drinking and they're going to minimize the things that they did. And you really can't talk about them at first because you don't want to, you know, you don't need an audience to do those things. But also it's possible that the person might need hospitalization. And it's, you know, one person can be on the phone making arrangements for the person to be hospitalized or get a doctor to come and see them. Or maybe you're going to have to take them out in two loads to the car, you know, and get a gurney, and it's going to take two people really to get them out, to take them to a hospital. So having two people along really makes sense from a lot of different directions. But it will save your life if you do it, too. And, you know, you may go in there sometime, and there may be a fellow in there, and he may be in bad physical condition, and he may have puked all over himself or defecated or whatever it happens to be, and maybe you're going to have to wash them up and clean them up a bit in order to make them feel better about themselves. And therefore, men make 12-step calls on men, women make them on women, because it makes it much simpler that way. And give them aid, and give them first aid if they need it. Give them everything that you can to make them feel a little better about living and feel it's more valid to do so. The one thing that I want to say is that, remember, you know, there's a possibility that you go on a 12-step call and for some man, and the wife is there or the girlfriend, and she might be scantily clad in a negligee or something like that, and that you might feel some temptations to do something if him passed out on the bed over here. Maybe she would make some overtures, because that happens as well. And with two people there, it's not likely that you're going to indulge yourself in the 13th step right there on a 12-step call. So don't put yourself in a position to be embarrassed. Don't put yourself in a position to be harmed. I've been on 12-step calls in many places. Some places that, you know, I've walked in and I got my shoes dirty when I walked across the carpet or walked across the floor. Some places that I never understood how anyone could possibly live that way. I've been in neighborhoods where I wouldn't go during the daytime, and I've never had any fear, because I know that as long as I'm going out and doing what God wants me to do, that I'm going to be safe and that I don't have to worry about what's going to happen. I've made 12-step calls on people that are sitting there with a gun in their hands, and on and on and on. I've never had any real fear. You know, I just say, hey, give me the gun. You know, put the gun over there. Because they don't really want the gun. They don't want to use the gun. They don't want to do anything else. So you really don't have to be afraid of what situation you're going to enter, because actually God is going to take care of you, because you're doing what God wants you to do. You're doing the very simple thing when you go on a 12-step call of helping another human being, helping someone who can't help themselves. And isn't that what really God wants us to do? You know, God suggested that how can we serve him? How can we serve him best? And we can serve him best by helping our fellow man. And that's the object of 12-step calls. It's the very beginning of sponsorship, possibly. One of the two members will generally end up being the sponsor of the individual. And that's the way it should be. And that's much of the initial approach to the new member. You can do this in a hospital or in a treatment center or in a jail or in their home or in a hotel or on the street. It doesn't make any difference where the individual is. You can find them if you want them. All you have to do is to make yourself available, give your name and phone number to the central office, and they'll call upon you. And you'll find some fine members of Alcoholics Anonymous yet to be. It's hard to believe that some of those people that you'll make 12-step calls are going to be our most trusted servants somewhere in the future, I'll tell you. Peg?
Okay, so now you got the guy, and you got, or the gal, and you got him pinned, boy, and he makes that dreadful error of saying to you, will you be my sponsor? No, I always get kind of amused about that. You know, they kind of... Some people enter... Have you had the experience, or if you are a sponsor, have you ever had the experience of being interviewed for sponsorship? You know, where they come up and they ask you these leading questions to find out if you're going to really be nice to them or mean to them or anything, you know. Kind of amusing. Let me say this first. I'm really grateful to be here for another reason, and that is that the high for today in Bellevue, Nebraska is zero. That's the high. God knows, I think we're supposed to have wind chills of 70 below, so it's kind of nice. So now they've asked you, and you take off. Now let me give you a sort of a basic idea of, there are various and sundry of ways of sponsoring, and there is no mysterious class of sponsor. You know, we aren't, it seems like sometimes that we all go to a school, and it's called the mean school. You know, and if you're people always talk about their sponsors like they're these big purple giant eaters, you know, these guys, people eaters, you know, and or the Incredible Hulks or something. But, you know, sometimes it seems like we practice a permanent scowl. You know, we go home and look in the mirror and scowl, you know, just so that when they come and tell us these things, we can scowl properly at them. But when we take, why is it necessary, you know, for you, whatever type of sponsor you end up being? Why is it necessary to sponsor? You know, why do I think it's necessary? And this is my opinion. First of all, I think it's necessary because I need a framework with it, really a permanent, continuous framework to give of myself. Because if I don't have that permanent framework to give of myself, my natural inclination is to go back into being self-centered and selfish. And so I need that framework. I need for my sponsor to know me. And by the way, let me add this. One of the things that is very helpful to me, and it isn't because I consider myself to be some kind of paragon of virtue or anything else, but one of the things that's very helpful to me is to have the person that I sponsor do a fifth step with me. Now, I know that in some parts of the country this is frowned upon. But let me say this again. If there is a weakness in Alcoholics Anonymous, it is in the area of sponsorship. And I know this because I know that there are stretches of Alcoholics Anonymous across this country that are just as gray as an elephant. And then every once in a while you'll get a hot spot. And there is where, you know, where the people seem to be enthusiastic, where they're happy asses, you know? And when there, you find one of those hot spots, it's generally where there is an emphasis on sponsorship. And the reason for this is because we build a big family. It's a big family. And if I have a person and they do a fifth step with me, you know, I know that I am going to respect that confidence. If you have a sponsor, you have to, regardless of anything else, you have to place your welfare in their hands, at least temporarily. Certainly not like you do to God. But it's a very similar transition. And in that sense, you have to trust. You've got to trust somebody. And you know something? I have never, ever known any one single person who's been hurt permanently out of a sponsorship relationship. Not one. Sure, people have been mad at me, and, you know, they've called me a dictator and, you know, all that sort of thing. But that's a growing process. It gives me the opportunity to look at what I'm doing. Because do you think that when you jump into sponsorship at a year or a year and a half or 2 years that you're going to sponsor the same as you do when you're sober 20 years? Of course not. We change, too, you know, as sponsors change. We grow, hopefully. If we don't, we go. You know, you either grow or go. You either grow or shrink. You know, whatever it is. And sponsors are no different than that. So I have gone through, you know, different stages in sponsorship. I would encourage anyone to try sponsorship. Really. And I'll tell you another good reason why. I don't know how it is here in Shreveport, but I know that like 5 years ago in Omaha, something happened. Even 8 years ago. All of a sudden, it just blew up. I mean, we had a few, and then it just went kapow. We have 283 meetings a week in the Omaha area. We have three treatment centers. We have diversion programs. We are getting new people so fast that you can't even believe it. And who's going to take care of them? Who was there for you when it was small? So you guys have got to get in there and help us. We're tired. You know, you've got to. The new people have got to get in there and pitch in. Give back what you were given. You know, we can't do it all, those of us who sponsor actively. You guys have got to pick up the load. And you should, because that's what I did, and I'm still here. So not only is it my responsibility to do that because of the people, but it helps other people. It gets me out of myself. It helps them. And it ensures that I am not going to be bored. When I'm going to tell you something. They can say anything they want to about alcoholics, but there is one sin of which we have never been accused, and that is of being boring. We are anything but boring. Frustrating, maddening. I love to see people going through the stages of not only of sponsorship, but of sobriety. You know, you get to that about a year and a half, 2.5, 3 years stage where you're just, I've got to be free. You guys say the same thing all the time. What am I going to do? You know, everybody is typical, you know. Well, I got to visit around, you know. I don't like you guys much anymore. I need fresh water, you know, and not realizing that really we're stagnant within ourselves. And I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you because I've done the same thing. And it's funny, through the stages of sponsors, this is a continuing responsibility. Now, what do I ask my people to do? If they're new, I ask them to call me every day. I ask them to go to a meeting every night for 6 weeks. I ask them to pick up coffee cups and ashtrays and greet people and do just little stuff like that. You know, that's not too much. I ask them, I like to see them at least 3 times a week because they're new. Now, as they are sober longer, then those sorts of requirements diminish somewhat. Depends on how sick they are. Sandy Shupp was real sick, let me tell you. I was dragging her out of her house for 2-3 years of sobriety. I want to be alone. I don't want you to be alone. So, what really you are helping this person to do, see, were you a very disciplined person when you drank? I mean, did you keep your, disciplined, you know, like, oh, here's my shot glass and here's my thing. You know, hell, I was lucky to remember where I'd put it. I hid them all over the place, so and I'd just be so joyous when I'd stumble on one of them that I'd forgotten I'd hidden. You know, I was not disciplined at all. I was lucky to get out of bed. So I think we have to, it says in the big book, we have to change 100%. They don't ask much, you know, just 360 degrees. Of course, I could have used the 360-degree turn. Thank God they didn't come up and stab their fingers at me and say, you have to change now everything, right away, because it was impossible, you know. But very gradually, lovingly, they helped me to change. So in the stages of this continuing sponsorship, what have I gone through? I'm typical, pretty typical. So here's the sort of stages I've come up with. First of all is the white charger phase. And that is when you're out to sober everybody up, even the duck. Everybody's got a problem. You've been through that, you know, he's got a problem, you know. Well, he may have a problem, but it may be just that he's a kind of a real, has a personality like a, no, I'm not going to say that. Anyway, he's got a bad personality, and he might just have a problem with that, or he might have a problem with this or that, but he might not have a problem with alcohol. Well, I didn't care. You know, I didn't care. I'd drag him in, you know, sit down, shut up, you know, and listen. You know, and they said, but I drank 3 years ago. I don't know what you're talking about. That sort of thing. So I went through that white charger phase. And I could usually tell when I was losing them, because I'd go on a harangue, you know, and they'd get this glaze over their eyes, you know, like, and then they'd say things like, that's been very nice for you, you know, and I'd have to give up. So then they insulted me. You know, they hurt my feelings. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I told them right off. You know, I said, now listen, I am very sensitive. And of course, you know how they responded to that. They said, no, you're not. You're a touchy bitch. And that's exactly what I was, too. So I got my feelings hurt. You know, they'd hurt my feelings, and they'd say, we don't want to hear you. We don't want to do what you want us to do. We don't need that. And so I'd sulk. Now, I'm sober, and I'm sponsoring, but I'm sulking, you know. Well, okay. I don't know how you are, but I am either full speed ahead or collapse. I'm better at that. I'm just sort of half speed and half collapse now. But, I mean, I was full speed ahead or collapse. So when people hurt my feelings, I say, well, then to hell with you. Just to hell with you. I won't help you at all. And when I was in my white charger phase, see, I'd tell you anything. I mean, it's hard lines, you know, really sock it to them and stuff. And then I entered, obviously, because I had been hurt so desperately, I went into my shrinking violet stage. And by the way, I want to say something right here. The shrinking violet stage is when you're afraid to say much. Because you might get, it's not because you're afraid you're going to hurt them, it's because you don't want them hurting you. And at this stage of your sponsorship, you know, this is probably one of the worst stages to go through, because more people die from bad sponsorship than from no sponsorship. And that is the truth, because weak sponsorship allows the alcoholic to do anything and justify it. But if I'm a strong sponsor and they don't like what I say, really that's okay with me, because I realize that I cannot sponsor everybody the way that other people do. I can only sponsor the way I do. But a weak sponsor says basically, whatever. Do whatever. Well, at that stage in my sobriety, whatever usually was self-destructive. And I have literally seen people pampered, babied, cajoled to death. And you know, we don't die good. We die tacky. And I don't, you know, so I have determined that I will never, ever, if possible, go into the shrinking violet stage again. Because, see, another thing that happened to me during that time was that I knew it was wrong. I knew it was wrong. And I hated it because I was afraid. My fear was controlling me. My people-pleasing was controlling me. And I wasn't telling the truth. I wasn't being true to me. So then I, of course, the pendulum swings the other way, and I moved into what I call my blue lip stage. And the blue lip stage of sponsorship is that stage in which you say, to hell with the shrinking violet. You either do what I say or ship out, buddy. And this is what I call the God stage of sponsorship, in which you approve or disapprove of everything that your people do. You know, if you screw around, you know, then I disapproved and I get blue lips, you know, pressed hard together. And I'd say, well, all right, but you know, and by body language and by spoken language, I could, you know, they could tell that I was not approving. You know, I'd have to approve or disapprove of what you do. It doesn't affect me one bit, but it does affect what you do. Your actions are going to be your actions, and they are going to be the thing that determines whether you stay sober or not. It doesn't hurt me if you drink, but it sure as hell hurts you. And if you've been around AA a long time and you haven't been sober, then you got to change something. Something has to change. You know, that's awful hard for a prideful alcoholic. To say, something I'm doing is not right. You know, something is not right here. And that's tough for us. I don't know, because I'm still here and I'll be here, hopefully, for the rest of my life. I hope that I'm one of these old biddies, you know. Even if I get bedridden, I'm going to be having them call me on the phone, and I'll be saying, yes, yes, you know, and talking to them. And I want to be active. I want to be on the porch in my rocking chair and have somebody come and get me and take go with me on 12-step call. That's the way my sponsor is, and that's the way I want to be, and I hope to be, because it makes things interesting. It keeps me active. It keeps things green. It keeps me from being bored, you know, from, you know, that old business of,
is this all there is? Am I going to be walking the gray halls of Alcoholics Anonymous forever?
No, and sponsorship never allows you that, because something is always popping when you're sponsoring people. So it's important. Now, at this stage of my sobriety and my sponsorship, I realize with a very full impact that I am but an instrument of the higher power. I'm just an instrument. I'm just the channel. I am not the fountain. I am just the channel. And I hope to be of service in this fashion for the rest of my life. You know, sponsorship usually ends up as a mutual aid and friendship. Those people that I sponsor help me far more than I help them. And when we reach an adult relationship such as that, that's friendship. And I didn't know that. That ends the first class. And we would like to, Sandy, I don't know what to do now. You tell me. Why don't we take just a short 5-10 minute break? Everybody get some coffee. If you might, I can't read that one, but butcher knives, guns, etc. This was before central office. You know, one of the things about Alcoholics Anonymous is we have to learn how to be flexible. And if you can't find another woman to go or another man to go with you, then for heaven's sake, take somebody else. It's better to take somebody else than to take nobody else. You know, whether it be. So I think that's a valid question. I think we need to be flexible about that. How do you feel about a sponsor who tells a pigeon, do it if it makes you happy or whatever? Well, not much. Because the things that I did to make me happy got me in a lot of trouble. Especially when I was first sober. Does there ever come a time when your sponsor and you are on totally different circumstances and you're not connecting, you feel like she's your baby? Well, basically, I think what that means is, are there times when you outgrow your sponsor? Most of the time, what I suggest in situations like that is that you give it a little time. Have a time frame of, say, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, a month, whatever it is that suits you, to see that it isn't us. And if it's still the same way, then I would suggest that you find another sponsor. You know, because if you really... There are people who quit growing, let's face it. You know, who just don't. They are talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk. I really take this sponsorship thing seriously. It's kind of like getting a divorce or something, you know. But when circumstances arise like that, and they do, they may be exceptions, but they do arise, then I think you give it some time and then get, if nothing changes, is change sponsors.
First question I have here, it says, how can you effectively sponsor 37 people, have them call you every day, see them 3 times a week, etc.? Well, that's a very good question. And if you want to follow me around sometime, I'll show you how it's done. I can't really tell you how it's done. There are 9 of those people who live out of town, and they call me every Thursday night somewhere between, usually 6 and 10 o'clock, and I have a conversation with them. Those that are new that live out of town that I sponsor, write me a letter each week and let me know what's going on. We discuss what they have written. And as far as the remainder of them are concerned, my ability to see them, they have to go to 2 meetings a week where I go. And so I'm going to see them there. And if they have something to talk about, I'm more than willing to talk about them. The people that I sponsor in various stages of sobriety, I expect a phone call from each of the people that I sponsor, a meaningful phone call a week. If they're brand new, I expect it every day. And if they are unwilling to do those things, they can frankly get another sponsor, because I don't mess around with it. I don't have the time to mess with somebody who wants to mess around. And if they really want to stay sober and if they really want some help, I'll do anything in the world to help them. But if they just want to mess around and play games, and there are some people who ask me to sponsor them because I'm, you know, an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they think it's, well, I'll get one of the big guys in AA to sponsor me. And that doesn't work very well, because you can always tell which ones they are. And what you do with them is you treat them like a brand new person, and they either like it or they go away. But the fellows that I've been sponsoring, and I say this is 37, this has been on a continuing basis, usually from the time they first got sober. And they're busily, actively engaged in sponsorship themselves, so it's really not too hard to do. If someone refuses to take your direction, what should you do then? Well, it's a very simple thing. The conversation that I have goes something like this. If you're unwilling to take the actions that I impose over your thinking, then perhaps you ought to find someone that you respect enough to do this, because you're calling me your sponsor is a sham, and obviously it's not to your best efforts. I want for you to stay sober, and I want for you to be the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous you can be, and you can only be that if you have someone to sponsor you whom you can take direction from. And that's real simple. Why do you give them more liquor when they're already drunk, especially if you don't know how much they already have? Because you can drink enough to kill you in a one-day period, something or another. Well, there are very few people who die from a result of drinking. And the reason for that is that physically what happens is that we detox. You can't stay drunk any more than 10 days in a row. It's just physically impossible. And you will begin to detox sometimes from both ends at the same time. So there's no such thing as a person getting too drunk. Actually, what happens is they get sober and don't have anything to drink is when they fall apart. So I'm not sure that I really understand the question. I don't go around giving people things to drink anyway. If someone you're sponsoring continues to drink, yet keeps asking you for help, how long should you hang in there? If someone that I'm sponsoring drinks, they have to come back to me and ask me to sponsor them. And they have to say, please, would you be my sponsor? And then I will sponsor them again. And if they don't do that, they got another sponsor. I don't know who it is. Maybe it's God. How do you answer the question, how do you find a sponsor? We're going to talk about that in the next section. Individual too sick to make a call. Do you believe? I don't know what that means. I don't know who wrote this. Do you believe you always know your limit? Who wrote that? What's the first part? Individual too sick to make a call. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's no doubt about that. You know, you have to, they may be too drunk or too sick to make decisions. And that's what the 12-step call for, really, is to guide them to making a decision to go to AA, isn't it? Guide them to a decision to stop drinking. They don't know to do that. They don't think that they can live without drinking. We know that you can live without drinking. You can live very well. And this question says, do you believe you always know your limit? Well, my body knows its limit. My mind knows its limit. I end up running out of mind. I end up running out of body. I end up running out of spirit. I get angry and that sort of thing. Then I know what I've got to do is to get away and rest. And there are periods of times when I just go away. I just disappear. I tell everybody I'm gone. You know, where are you going? Well, I'm going away. I'll see you later. And, you know, take off and go to a conference. And just run away from home and get a little rest. But, you know, go fishing. But tell those people that you're sponsoring to call someone else if they have a problem. and just get some rest. Take a vacation. Do those things. You need to do that sometimes, because otherwise it just gets too, you just get too bent. My question is involved. Just ask me, Dolores. Dolores, I'm asking you. If they say please, then sponsor. You know, I don't really feel that I have the prerogative of not sponsoring somebody. There are times when someone, I don't sponsor drug addicts, for an example, because I don't have any experience with that. And I can only share my experience. If they're alcoholics and they want help, I feel that I have to be available to help. And I don't care what they say. I don't really pay attention to what, you know, somebody comes up and wants me to sponsor them. I can't really pay too much attention to what they say about me or about themselves either, because generally they're too sick to know what the real truth is. And what we have to do is to find out. And so we listen. And you treat them just like you treat anybody else. Regardless of what they say, you treat them the way you treat anyone that you're sponsoring. You give them the same direction. If they're brand new, call me every day, go to a meeting every day, don't take a drink one day at a time. If you really feel like you're going to drink, you know, make sure you call me first. I don't care what time of day or night it is. I'm willing to help you any way I possibly can. You know, I'll go to hell for you and back. But if you want to go to hell by yourself, you're just going to have to go to hell by yourself. I'll help. I'm glad to help any way I can help. And that's what we have to do. We just have to be helpful. And that's the end of this group of questions, and we're going to go on into the next section here. Just a second. This section has to do with picking the sponsor. And says, even when consideration is given to assigning the 12 steppers, there will be times when the sponsor and the prospective member don't click. And those things happen. Some members, because of their training or occupation or natural talents, are really better presenting new ideas to others. There's a natural tendency to call upon those people to do all of the 12-step work or sponsorship. And it's really not necessary to do that. Anyone who's an alcoholic and has a desire to help someone else is perfectly capable of going on a 12-step call if they've been sober for a few months and taking a younger member along with them. And anyone who has been sober for a few months in Alcoholics Anonymous and has a regular attendance at meetings and has a sponsor themselves is certainly capable of sponsoring a new person. Members with ordinary ability, just the, you know, the simple person who really is not, you know, the quiet type, they can sponsor people just as well as the mouthy ones. It really doesn't make any difference. It's a matter of having a desire to help somebody else. So there isn't any mysterious class of sponsors in AA. Anyone can really be a sponsor if they have a desire to help. And that's the main thing that you have to take into consideration. You know, there are some members of Alcoholics Anonymous who've been sober for 20 or 30 years whom I wouldn't ask to sponsor me on a bet because they're unprincipled. I'm not looking for good people because I'm not going to find any good people in AA. And I've discovered that. But I will find some principled people. And I picked the man to sponsor me whom I believe is not a good man by any stretch of the imagination. And I mean that. He is not a good man. Clancy ain't a good man. He's a lot of things, but he isn't a good man. But he is a most principled member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he is the most principled member that I know. Now, there may be others that you know, but he is the most principled that I know. And I need someone to be principled to give me the guidance. How long they've been sober, I can tell you one thing very simply. If you're going to pick a sponsor, you have to pick someone who's been sober longer than you have. And there's a very good reason for that. And the good reason for it is that, you know, if I could, for an example, you know, I know Lou, and Lou has a good program. And he's active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could, you know, he's been sober for 9 years. And I could ask Lou to sponsor me. But if I asked him to sponsor me, knowing that I've been sober for over 19 years, and I ask Lou for some direction in my life, he would say, well, Dick, why don't you do that? And I'd say, okay. And then I'd walk away and I'd say, that's what I'd say if I'd been sober for 9 years. That isn't what I really need. So I would discharge what he had to say in thinking that I knew best. So I must have someone that's been sober longer than I have, just for simply my own ego reason. It doesn't have anything to do with a person's ability to sponsor, because Lou would be as capable of sponsoring me as anyone else would. But unfortunately, he hasn't been sober longer than I have. And therefore, he can't do that. It's just impossible. Because my ego would not permit that. I don't think it says some members think a person should have at least 6 months of continuous sobriety before they go on 12-step calls or before they sponsor. Frankly, I think the sooner you go on 12-step calls and the sooner you start sponsoring, the better you're going to be. As long as you have a sponsor to guide you and to help you with the new person, that's all you really need. The only thing that we have to have is acquire a good knowledge of the 12-step program of recovery and understand that that's all we have to give away. The only thing that I have to give away is my experience. My experience has been that of recovering through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's all I have to give away. And that's all I think anybody has to give away. That's the only message that I have. And there are some people that seem to think that they have another message, and I don't know exactly where they're coming from, but I feel that it's necessary simply to go on that basis that I know only my experience, and I can share that, and I can share nothing else. Okay?
Obviously, there, because of our limits on time, you know, I'm sure that all of us could talk a long, long time about picking a sponsor and finding someone, my basic comment on that would be to look around the meetings and see who not only is sharing things and happy and what, you know, there are a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are great at talking the talk. They can talk the talk and it just comes trippingly off their tongue. They're silver-tongued devils, you know. But when it comes to walking the walk, there's a disparity there. And I think what you have to do, and you see, the 12 steps of our program says that having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, the previous 11, that we carried the message and so forth, and it practices principles in all our affairs. And so if you walk the walk, you are actually practicing the 12 steps in its fullest. And that means not only within the meetings. It's easy for me to be nice for an hour or so, isn't it? It's easy for me to be nice. I mean, I walk in here and I'm just nice. But it's when I'm at home with those mood-changing people. You know, I am not taking or never have taken any, at least not since I've been sober, any mood-altering drugs, but I have been around a lot of mood-altering people. And I think that you've got to really look and see somebody that you think is walking the walk, you know, who has something that you think you want, you know, that certain twinkle in the eye, you know, and that peppiness of step and that willingness to do those things. You'll see those people again and again and again because they show up at meetings like real alcoholics always do and like fake alcoholics don't. Anyway, okay, now, what about the prospective person that you're going to sponsor? Now, there's a debate here, and it really is nothing but regional. In California, they're called babies. Some places, they're called sponsees, and that sounds like some kind of sponge or something. I don't know what. Or a disease, maybe, or something. Sponsee, that's funny, isn't it? And then where I came into the program, they are called pigeons, and I know Marvette doesn't like pigeons, but that's the way I grew up. That's what they were called. I was even called a squab because I was too young to be a pigeon, you know. But anyway, it really, Dr. Bob called them pigeons, so it really did start in Akron. And sometimes they called them Mark, and sometimes they called them, what the hell is it, prospect. Like it was a business deal, you know, sort of thing. So it really doesn't make any difference. But anyway, I'll be comfortable with pigeons. So the prospective pigeon, the person that's going to be sponsored. And it says, a drinking alcoholic who is still in his confusion and sickness is looking for someone or something that will lead him out of his darkness and despair. He needs you, but never forget that you need him just as desperately if you want contented sobriety. And that's something I think is forever. I have to remember that I need you much more than you need me. I mean, that's, you know, that has to do with humility and everything. You know, it really does. And I'm not an humble person. I'm arrogant as hell. Just arrogant as hell. Always will be, I think. But, you know, if I'm going to have contented and permanent sobriety, then I have to have a degree of humility in my life. And by the way, let me insert this at this time. I would like for you, as just an exercise, if you're a little bored one day, to take a look at the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not as they apply to the groups of Alcoholics Anonymous, but as they apply to you as individuals. If it hadn't have been for the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have divorced old what's-his-name over here a long time ago. They are actually ego deflation at depth, individually and group. But they really are meant for you to take personally, too. You know, and there is nothing I enjoy than a good study of the tradition. So that's really, you know, that's just an aside. One of the foundation stones of the AA program is that an alcoholic cannot cure himself. You know, how many times have we said, just leave me alone, I want to be happy? You know, if I went, you know, I felt like that sometimes. You ever felt like going in the closet and sitting down, pulling all the clothes down over your head? You know, just sitting there a while and letting out a primal scream or two, you know? Well, you know, I do that, and after the scream, then I get to thinking. And, you know, if I went in there semi-happy, I'll come out there depressed as hell. Because my mind has a tendency to go to every negative thing that's happened to me. You know, I'm not a naturally grateful person. I don't spring out of bed and say, I'm so glad to be alive and it's wonderful today. And oh, is that wonderful, those few little people down there waiting to be fed their eggs. And oh, what an opportunity this is for me. Thank you, God, for this. You know, I'm not like that at all. You know, I get up and son of a bitch. Where are the Cheerios? You know, that's the way I am. I, for years, made lunches for the kids to go to school, you know. And I'd sit there at the counter and say, God damn.